Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Hi, this is Bernard Gwertzman. I'm the moderator of our conference today. I'm happy to introduce my good friend Mohammed Bazzi, who is an adjunct senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also teaches journalism at New York University and for many years was a Middle East bureau chief for Newsday based in Beirut. And he's been a keen observer all the time of the Lebanese political situation, which I have to confess I find often very baffling. So I'm hoping that Mohammed will clear it up for all of us as best he can. First of all, I'd like to ask you, Mohammed, what's happened in the last couple of weeks to cause all this concern in the United States and elsewhere about the political situation in Lebanon?
Thank you, Bernie. I think this latest twist of events in Lebanon started on January 12th when Hezbollah and its allies in the Lebanese government, they withdrew 11 ministers from the cabinet. And so that was one-third plus one members of the cabinet. There are 30 members of the Lebanese cabinet. And when that happened, the Lebanese government collapsed. That was the government of Prime Minister Saad Hariri. And that set off this last chain of events where we now have a new prime minister-designate, Najib Miati, who, much like Mr. Hariri, is a Sunni billionaire businessman who has very wide contacts in the region. He also happens to be close to the Syrian regime, but he also has good relationships with the Saudis and with others in the region. So this latest twist started on January 12th, but it's really rooted in a conflict that began several months ago. And this was when leaks began to emerge from the international tribunal that's investigating the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri, Saad Hariri's father. And those leaks were pointing to the fact that the indictments were going to name members of Hezbollah as being responsible for this assassination. So as those leaks began to intensify, and this was last spring around May or June and then into the summer, Hezbollah really started a full-fledged campaign trying to discredit the tribunal, casting doubt on its evidence, on the witnesses, and the group also began to pressure Saad Hariri to end Lebanese cooperation with the tribunal and to publicly reject its findings. Hariri stood his ground through most of these months. He was in negotiations with Hezbollah, either directly or through intermediaries, and there were also larger negotiations between the Syrian regime and the Saudi regime to find a mechanism to bring Hezbollah and Saad Hariri together. That all collapsed in mid-January and set off this rather quick series of events where the Hezbollah withdrawal from the government led to its collapse and then nominating a new prime minister.
I hope that's clear. But I'd like to just, one thing has always bothered me. At the time of the assassination of Rafik Hariri in February of 2005, the almost universal assumption was he was killed by Syrian agents. And in fact, following that, the Syrians, because of the demonstrations throughout Syria, throughout Lebanon, were forced to pull out their troops from Lebanon who had been there for, what, a dozen, 15 years. And I missed the transition. When was it always assumed that these Syrian agents were Hezbollah and not, that they were Lebanese and not Syrians themselves?
That's an excellent question. That's actually a question on the mind of many Lebanese, of how the blame shifted quite publicly from Syria to Hezbollah. I think we're going to have to wait to see when the indictments are unsealed, which should be in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. We're going to see what evidence there is against any of the named suspects. And whether there are larger charges. There's been talk about potentially conspiracy charges and also terrorism charges emanating from the indictments. So that could potentially, you know, target members of the Syrian regime. There's also been leaks in some of the Arabic press and also in some Western media that the conspiracy charges could even touch Iran. I don't have any inside information on that. I only sort of know what's been reported in the Arab press on that. But Bernie's question is very important, because one of the things that had to happen for the agreement for Saad Hariri to take office as prime minister in November of 2009 was that he had to make peace with the Syrian regime and with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
This was after his re-election.
That was after the parliamentary elections in June of 2009,
right.
And when it was clear that he was going to be the candidate of his parliamentary bloc. So he's been prime minister once so far. Saad Hariri has been prime minister for 14 months. And at that point, it became clear that he had to make his peace with Syria. And then this past summer, he went to Syria and basically, to the shock of quite a few Lebanese, almost absolved the Syrian regime of responsibility. Because, as you said, a lot of the speculation, a lot of the accusations that were emanating from Hariri, Saad Hariri, and his entire camp pointed the finger at Syria. And certainly at the time, that was the scenario that made the most sense.
And there were leaks from the original investigators charging that the heads of intelligence and the military intelligence were involved.
There were leaks. There were also an actual report, one of the earliest reports in October of 2005, sort of pointed the finger. Now it's emerged that some of these, Hezbollah calls them the false witnesses, some of these witnesses that, you know, were either, some speculations that they were plants by the Syrian regime, or that they were plants by Syrian opposition, people who are opposed to Bashar al-Assad's regime, that they were giving false information to the early investigation. And that's one of the things that's helped Hezbollah cast doubt on the investigation right now. Certainly a lot of people are wondering in Lebanon how this blame has shifted almost entirely away from Syria and just toward Hezbollah.
Right. Do we go on to, should we throw it open to questions here?
We can do that. We can also, if any of this is unclear, we'll sort of take questions about it.
Talk
some more.
I can ask another question or so. But why don't we throw it open to the listening audience?
If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question comes from Shendrak Upincholi, Overseas India Weekly.
Oh, hi. Because there are so many Middle Eastern countries in turmoil, can I ask just two questions? One about the Lebanon, which you are discussing, and how much hand Iran has in promoting this unrest and financing Hezbollah, how the Sunni and Shia religion will play a part in Lebanon. And on the larger question, in the Middle East, can we divide it into two parts, like people, like Egypt, Iran?
Ask the question, and I'll try to deal with the larger regional issues as well. But tell me sort of what your first question is about sectarianism in Lebanon,
right,
and Sunni Shia tension in Iran. Okay.
The second one is about there are Western influences in Egypt and there are Egypt, etc., Iran, and in Saudi Arabia and other countries, there is a strong religious fundamentalism. Are we going to have anti-U.S. governments up in this turmoil in several nations?
Okay. I'll take the first question, which is about the sort of the Shia Sunni sectarianism and tension in Lebanon, and that certainly it's a very good question, and it pertains to what's been happening on the streets in Lebanon certainly this past week. So when Prime Minister Hariri
back a little in history. Explain how this agreement was worked out on division of power.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so we'll go back quite far in history and to Lebanese independence. So in 1943, when Lebanon finally won full independence from France, the Lebanese leaders got together and they agreed on something called the National Pact. And this was an agreement that was actually unwritten, so it was a spoken agreement, and often it's mistaken that the Lebanese constitution calls for this, but it's not actually in the constitution. So the National Pact called for the president to be a Maronite Christian, the prime minister to be a Sunni, and the speaker of parliament to be a Shiite. And there's also a distribution of parliamentary seats, sort of. At that point, there was 6-5 ratio of Christians to Muslims in parliament, and this trickled all the way to all kinds of government jobs. But the top jobs were divided by the three largest communities at the time. And this agreement has persisted until today. So the prime minister always has to be a Sunni, and the president has to be a Maronite Christian, and the Shiites have the speaker of parliament. So one of the issues that just emerged this past week was who exactly gets to name. There are quite a few Sunni politicians in Lebanon, as we've seen with Najib Miati emerging, and other names that were thrown out as potential candidates. So one of the questions that emerged is who gets to decide who gets Sunni choices, and the Sunni community in Lebanon was quite angry, especially the religious leaders, and also we saw some action on the street, was quite angry with this perception that Hezbollah was pushing the candidacy of Najib Maati and had been making the choice for the Sunni community. Certainly the Sunni leader who has the most widespread backing in Lebanon is Saad Hariri, thanks to the infrastructure that his father left behind, the political party and the charitable organizations, and the fact that his father was prime minister for much of the 90s into the mid-2000s. So he was the most popular leader, but in a lot of ways he was outmaneuvered by Hezbollah and its allies in this latest round, and it's caused this tremendous anger in the Sunni community, and this is one of the reasons for the protests that we saw on Tuesday on the streets. That was the day that Miati got the majority in parliament to get the call to form the government. So the dangers of this is that as tensions between the two communities persist, we're going to see the potential for long-term damage between Sunnis and Shiites in Lebanon. And certainly regionally, the events in Iraq have an influence on this, events in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia sees itself as the protector of the Sunni community in Lebanon, and Iran is Hezbollah's main financial and military backer, so it's trying to impose itself as the protector of the Shia community in Lebanon. I think that answers the first part of your question.
I can't remember the second.
The second part, I think, is about sort of events in Egypt and also the sort of Saudi Arabia, and I think the question was also about something of the U.S. role, and maybe I'll address that very briefly. I mean, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen in Egypt, and you know we're seeing this series of events unfold on the streets. Because tomorrow we'll see if these extremely large demonstrations take place. that are being called for after Friday prayers and the return of Mohammed al-Baradei to Egypt, you know, also gets into the mix. And the U.S. is I think, still trying to, the Obama administration is trying to come up with a coherent policy towards Egypt. It's in a difficult position because Mubarak is a longtime ally and sort of is the ultimate representation of kind of stability over democracy in the region. And, you know, for now he appears to still have the support of the ruling elite and most importantly of the Egyptian army and the security forces, and they haven't abandoned him. So that's one place where it's diverting from Tunisia, where the military basically abandoned Ben Ali rather quickly as the protests mounted.
Will we have anti-U.S. governments, in your opinion, later
I mean, that's
on?
Difficult. I think if you're asking that about Lebanon, you know, will Najib Meati's government be anti-U.S.? I think that might be an oversimplification to label it that way, because he certainly realizes that he needs to work with the U.S., and it's also an oversimplification to describe him purely as the Hezbollah candidate. I mean, Hezbollah definitely pushed him over the edge, and they got him elected. He wouldn't have, they got him elected within parliament. He wouldn't have gotten this level of support within parliament if it was not for Hezbollah. Will he be actively against the U.S.? Probably not. As we also have to give him a chance to form his government. You know, there's still negotiations. He's still trying to bring people from the Hariri camp into his government, and this might take several weeks to form the government. And ultimately, you know, all sorts of deals get made in Lebanon. Everyone always has very fiery rhetoric, and then in the end, there are compromises. Now, it looks like Hariri is pretty adamant this time, and that he's going to now become the opposition and stay out of the government. But some of the parties that are allied with him could potentially make some deals. I mean, so there are a few independents who are allied with him who could make a deal with Meati. But I don't think it's going to be an openly anti-U.S. government. Now, one of the central issues, and probably the issue that Hezbollah got guarantees about, is that Meati has to end cooperation with the International Tribunal. And that is going to be a provocative act for the U.S. and for the West in general. And that's where we might see some conflict.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Warren Strobel, McClatchy Newspapers.
Thanks. Can you hear me okay?
Yes,
we can hear you.
Two quick questions, if I could. First of all, could you talk a little bit about the mediation effort by the Saudis and the Syrians, and why? I'm a little unclear about why the Saudis in particular sort of seemed to quickly, not quickly, but they abandoned it. They apparently thought there was no further use in mediating. And then secondly, is the ultimate concern here in terms of Lebanon's internal situation that you might revert to a situation like you had in the 70s and early 80s with, you know, widespread assassinations, car bombings, et cetera?
Okay. I'll take the first question. You know, it's difficult to know what went on in the negotiating room between the Saudis and the Syrians. There's been a lot of conflicting information, especially in the Lebanese press and in the wider Arab press. Since the summer, the Saudis and the Syrians had been working on a deal where Hariri would remain as prime minister, but in exchange, and he would distance himself or potentially cut off all ties with the tribunal and also disavow it's the indictments once they come out. That was the version of events that's come out in the Lebanese press. The trick was sort of the timing of when that would happen, and also what Hariri would get in exchange for doing this. And this is where there are three or four or five different versions of events. Hezbollah and its allies insist that Hariri had committed to doing this and that he backed out at the last minute, and therefore they no longer trusted him and they no longer saw him as someone they can work with, which is why they say that's why they were so insistent on him not returning as prime minister. Hariri's version of events is that he had made agreements or sort of accepted this in principle several months ago and that the details were still being worked out. Some of the things that Hariri was expecting in return were things that the Syrians would need to guarantee, such as disarming Palestinians, some Palestinian factions outside of the Palestinian refugee camps, having Lebanon, having Hezbollah pull some of its weapons out, and especially from parts of Beirut, and also potentially reduce some of its weapons capability even in its central sort of southern Beirut strongholds, and to also have an agreement that Hezbollah would not pull out of the government, would not pull its 11 ministers or the allied ministers out of the cabinet, and those three conditions were not met, and that might have led to this collapse. Now, one interesting thing about the Saudis is that they've been incredibly quiet in the past week. There's a lot of speculation that they've given quiet blessing to Najib Miati as prime minister, as some kind of compromise candidate, and that this quiet blessing was ultimately what enabled him to ascend, because without some kind of nod from Saudi Arabia, he wouldn't have done it, and he needed to peel off a couple of independents, and he also needed the support of Walid Jumblat, which he got, and seven of his votes in parliament. So that put him over the top. Miati also has significant. He's a billionaire, and he's made a lot of investments in telecoms, and especially in Africa. And he, as a Sunni sort of billionaire in the region, he has business dealings with the Saudis, and he needs to protect those dealings. And it's important for him, you know, not to be sort of in open war with Saudi Arabia. The second question is on about this sort of assassinations and whether we're seeing a return to Lebanon in the 70s, right?
Right.
Sort of, are you talking about inclusive of the civil war or in the lead up to the civil war?
I guess the lead up and the aftermath. Do you see the situation potentially returning to that kind of a situation?
There's been a lot of speculation on this, especially since 2008. In May 2008, when Hezbollah took over West Beirut for a few days and sort of imposed itself and kind of disarmed, very forcibly disarmed, Hariri's supporters. I think we didn't hit the moment of, I mean, that was close, of you know, widespread civil strife. But the situation we have today is that Hezbollah is so strong militarily. It has such a edge over the rest of the factions. And now, after the events of May of 2008, all the other factions realize this, that this imbalance of power is different than the situation in 1974, 75, at the beginning of the Civil War in April 75, where you had multiple factions, and you know, the PLO was the lead among them in terms of weapons and capability, but there were other factions, Christian factions, and also, and then the leftist factions that allied themselves with the PLO, they all had foreign suppliers, and they were acting as foreign proxies, and they had their own significant military capability. And the scene today is very different. So Hezbollah has sort of shown that on the street, on the ground, it can dominate fairly quickly, and that's almost something of a deterrent to the other factions. And one last thought on that, I think one of the things that turned Walid Jumblat, the Druze leader who's always been a very mercurial politician in Lebanon and has always been you know, willing to switch sides, as many Lebanese leaders have done over the years, was that experience in May of 2008. It seems that he realized that his allies at the time, that Hariri and others, were almost waiting for him to do the fighting, waiting for the Druze to do the very serious fighting with Hezbollah, and he was unwilling to do that.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Mitch Potter, Toronto Star Newspaper.
Yes, first of all, thanks for taking the time to do this today. I wonder if sort of zooming out from Lebanon and looking at the unrest that we're seeing in Egypt and the events in Tunisia and of course some street protests in even Yemen and other places. I wonder if you could address the fact that there seems, at least at this point, to be very little involvement of political Islam in what appears to be a pretty grassroots amount of protesting, and how significant you believe that is, that it's not the Muslim Brotherhood and some of the other factions that represent political Islam across the spectrum of these countries.
And it's not based on anti-Americanism.
that's a good, complex question. I think what we saw in Tunisia was certainly very broad-based uprising, and the backbone of it seemed to be the middle class and also unemployed and disappointed young people, and those factors drove it together, and also some labor factions, and the fact that the military remained on the sidelines. Now, the Islamists in Tunisia had been destroyed and weakened and driven into exile years ago, so they don't have much of a presence on the ground, and they've been jockeying in the past few weeks since Ben Ali was forced out. They've been jockeying to get back in. It doesn't seem like they're going to be very successful, but Tunisia's still up in the air. In Egypt, it's been interesting that the protests so far have been driven by young people and this sort of broader coalition of young people, secular movements, and some labor segments as well, especially the labor groups that are outside of Cairo, that is happening in Suez and other places. And though that coalition is different than the traditional kind of Muslim Brotherhood opposition to the regime, I think we need to see tomorrow if the Brotherhood has significant participation after Friday prayers. If these protests that are being organized tomorrow, and the expectation is that they're going to be even larger than the protests on Wednesday, that they might even be quite a lot larger because a lot of people will be going to the mosque, and that would indicate greater participation from the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the flip side to that is that then the regime in Egypt could say, okay, we've been blaming, this is what we've been telling you all along, these are the troublemakers, these are the Islamists, and they've been driving, they've been pulling the strings all along, which is not entirely true. So the regime might be able to sort of lay blame on the Islamists and to say this is what's been driving this, and then they might begin a much broader crackdown. I mean, we've seen sort of gradually increasing crackdowns in Egypt in the past couple of days, but really the regime hasn't flexed its muscle and its military might at all. And if we see a greater participation by Islamists, then they might use that as an excuse. And the regime in Egypt is also very good at using the Islamist boogeyman as something to advance to the West, as something to advance to the United States and Europe, and say, look, we're the only thing standing between Egypt and the Brotherhood taking power. And so far, that argument has worked for many years. Now, we're seeing a different kind of movement emerge, and maybe Western policymakers might reconsider, especially seeing a broader-based movement on the ground. In Yemen, it's difficult. Yemen is a very difficult country, and I'm not an expert on the ins and outs of Yemen, and it's hard to know how much Islamist influence is behind the very latest protests. It seems also driven by young people. I mean, there's also the South-North division in Yemen, which is very historic and driving some of this. Now, we can also look at Lebanon in this, is this an Islamist takeover of Lebanon, sort of if we put Hezbollah in the Islamist camp? That would be an oversimplification, because Hezbollah is certainly an Islamist movement. It's a Shiite Islamist movement. It's not the Brotherhood, it looks to Iran for religious guidance. But Lebanon is so mixed, and Hezbollah really realizes that it can't impose an Islamic vision on Lebanon. And their concern at the moment is that the government cut off cooperation and disavow the tribunal. So this is not Gaza in 2007. It's not Hamas trying to take over and take over, you know, fully and push Fatah out and also impose these social controls on society. You know, Hezbollah hasn't shown any signs of wanting to do that.
Can I ask a quick follow-up?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Picking up on what you've said, earlier you mentioned this poses a challenge for U.S. policymakers to find a way to have coherent policy across the region on these fast-moving developments. I dare ask you to do a little prediction here, but what do you see as the available options for U.S. foreign policy as these events develop? Do you see some kind of reconciliation for a more coherent policy with regard to, for example, the Mubarak regime?
Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a philosophical question at stake here of going back to the question of kind of stability versus democracy, right? So that had been the formula for U.S. policymakers. And certainly there have been a lot of pro-democracy rhetoric under the Bush administration and the freedom agenda that the Bush administration talked about all the time. But the rhetoric often wasn't backed up by action. And people in the Middle East, you know, grew very skeptical and very weary about this rhetoric. And almost, you know, there was a burst of enthusiasm after President Obama spoke in Cairo in June of 2009, a very eloquent speech, and there was a burst of enthusiasm in the region after that because it was very measured and very exciting, and then sort of pretty quickly there was little talk of democracy and sort of protecting human rights and those issues. So we come back to the philosophical question of stability versus democracy, but I think the situation we're in now is that these regimes may not be as stable as everyone had assumed they were. And in some ways it's sort of, you know, I'm sure these debates are taking place inside the administration of sort of which side of history does the administration and does the United States want to fall on. And you know, if I were to predict, you know, there will be people certainly arguing for continuing the policy of backing Mubarak because he's so central to U.S. interests, and Egypt is so central to U.S. interests in the region. But there's also a counter argument that, you know, Mubarak may, you know, we've known for a long time that his regime doesn't have a lot of popular legitimacy, and now it's being expressed on the streets. And why should the United States be wedded to Mubarak despite this? And I think we're seeing very small changes in the shades of rhetoric and statements that are coming out of Washington, where there's been expressions of support for, you know, Egypt and also the Egyptian people. And you know, there might be some moving away from backing Mubarak wholeheartedly. The administration probably has to take a country-by-country approach. I mean, it's going to be difficult because the situation in Tunisia is different than the situation in Egypt, and then Lebanon is different than both places, and certainly Yemen is its own case. So there is this opportunity for the administration right now in Egypt to kind of catch up. You know, one of the criticisms that emerged in the region was that the Obama administration was too slow in Tunisia, was too slow to declare its support for the Tunisian people, and only did it the day that Ben Ali fled. And this was noticed. This was noticed very strongly in the region. It became a topic of conversation on Al Jazeera and on a lot of the satellite channels and in a lot of newspapers. And this is an opportunity now in Egypt to sort of express greater support for democracy and reform, and for really pressuring a lot of these regimes to get their act together.
Next.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from James Kingfield, National Journal Magazine.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing this. Two quick questions. This new guy who's backed by Hezbollah, he will actually turn his back on the tribunal. He can afford to do that as a Sunni, given all the pressure that's built around finding out what the tribunal has to say. And secondly, where is the Lebanese army in all of this? You haven't said much about them, but
yeah.
Any indication of where they will come down if push comes to shove in this?
Mm-hmm. Good. Yes. You know, Nimati is going to have a very difficult time, especially within the Sunni community, turning his back on the tribunal. But I'm assuming, as many other analysts and people writing in the Lebanese press are assuming, that this was the promise that he must have made to Hezbollah, otherwise they wouldn't have supported him for prime minister. He's been very coy about it. In any statements that he's made, you know, he said he hasn't made a decision, and that it'll have to be a decision made by the entire cabinet, by the government itself. So that's, you know, one way of potentially spreading the blame around, that it's not just Miati as a personal decision that he's turning, shutting off the tribunal, or shutting out the tribunal from Lebanon, but that it's the government as a whole, and that's one of the things that's going to make for tortured negotiations over the makeup of the government in Lebanon, but that always happens. As a side note, I also think we're not going to see very many Hezbollah ministers in this government. I think their approach is always to have a few ministers. They've generally had two ministers in each government since 2005. They'll probably stay at that, two or three maybe. And then their allies get a lot more ministers. It's an effective way of keeping some distance, and at least some kind of deniability. And they also don't want to have too many ministries to manage, because there's a lot of just public criticism of the problems that emerge from each ministry and all of those things. But if somehow Miati doesn't do this, I would expect, they could bring the government down again. I mean, they're going to be, this is a government, in the last government, they had enough seats to bring the government down. In this government, between Hezbollah and all of its allies, old allies and new allies, they're going to have the majority, and they could bring the government down pretty quickly. So I think we'll see Miati trying to disperse the decision. And there's also, the country is very split over the whole idea of the tribunal. And the question in the wider Middle East is about stability and democracy. A question in Lebanon is about stability versus justice. And this is how Walid Jimblatt has been putting it in the past couple of months. And there are a lot of people in Lebanon that are saying, we don't want to hear any more about the tribunal. I mean, there are also a lot of people, especially in the Sunni community, who want justice for Rafiq Hariri, and it's going to be difficult to placate them. But Miati has to act on this fairly quickly. I think Hezbollah's ideal, and this is one of the things they were pushing Saad Hariri to do, is they want the government to cut off cooperation with the tribunal and to disavow it before the indictments are unsealed.
Yeah.
And the second question was, I've forgotten it now.
The Lebanese army.
Yes. Yes, good question. That's the Lebanese army has been on the sidelines through most of this. Most importantly for the tribunal, the army said months ago that they're not going to enforce, they didn't say this quite this directly, but they basically said that they're not going to enforce any sort of arrest warrant on anyone Lebanese. So that puts certainly any potential Hezbollah members who might be indicted, that puts them at ease. And basically the army is not going to take sides. That's what it's been saying. So there's very little danger, even if the Lebanese government doesn't end up cutting off its relationship with the tribunal, there's very little danger that anyone would actually enforce any arrest orders on the ground in Lebanon.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Next.
Our next question comes from Chandraka Pincholi, Overseas India Weekly.
Hi. Mr. Bazzi, in Saudi Arabia, because a lot of oil money pours in and populace is satisfied, do you see any cracks in the power of this theocracy? And because you were stationed in Iran for a long time, can you just give us an update on Iran and how the power play is going on there?
I was stationed in Iraq and then in Lebanon. I've gone to Iran on some visits, but I don't consider myself an Iran expert. So I'm going to have to pass on the Iran question because the government questions in Iran are very complicated, and I don't feel like I can address all of them. On Saudi Arabia and whether there are cracks, there is the central issue right now is the illness of King Abdullah, and he's still recuperating. He was in New York for several months in the hospital, had an operation, and then he's now, I think, in Morocco recuperating. And one of the things that seems to have happened, is there is the usual jockeying for succession, who's going to take power. Different factions among the Saudi princes. And one of the problems this might have caused in Lebanon is that there were different Saudi factions that had different priorities when it came to Lebanon. Saad Hariri may have been negotiating with several different factions. And, there's some speculation in Lebanon that he was led astray by some of the factions. But one of the factions specifically that wanted to take a harder line regarding Hezbollah. That's about the extent of my thoughts on Saudi.
Thank you. Next.
There are no more questions at this time.
Okay.
Is there anything we
I think
didn't
we've
cover?
Covered the waterfront.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you. Thank
Cheers.
You all for being on the
We're
call.
We're signing off. Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.